de trouver une petite partie, partie de ma vie. La vie c'est comme ça, la mort m'a visité. Debbie opened up the door and he said his sad goodbye. Goodbye to my love, farewell to everything. Everything was on my mind, my knees are knocking low, that heavy-hearted feeling sinking like the sun. He was smiling on me, smiling on me. Death was smiling on me. He was smiling on me. There's a heavy shrouded man, a sickle in his hand. Does he have a soul? You can't see his eyes. He just sees through you. He's wielding life around. He's come to chop them down. Like a lumberjack's plunder, he's laying waste. A song. Just the bells tolling, may people ringing home. A song, just the bells tolling, may people. Feeding from evening, your darkening light is true. Oh, it's gotta be true.
Listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We are broadcasting from the ancestral unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. In the last year, CITR has been digitizing our collection of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes containing an archive of audio broadcast on UBC's campus and community radio station from 1949 to the late 90s. With help from the UBC University Archives and the UBC Library Digitization Center, 400 audio files are now available for the public to listen and download, with more on the way. To share this history, we have made a series of documentaries produced by students and community broadcasters. This project is funded by UBC's Centennial Initiative Fund, celebrating a century of success at UBC. Tune in every Thursday at 4 p.m. for the next 4 weeks from January 14th to February 4th for a new documentary. And visit our website, citr.ca/docs, for podcasts, interviews with the producers, and more information.
Hi, this is Roger Allen. I'm live on your radio.
How old were you when the grunge scene started to get big in Vancouver?
How old was I? I think I was 18. So
yeah.
Probably the perfect age.
Yeah, definitely. And so your documentary is about kind of the rise of the grunge scene and some of the venues that were more important in Vancouver. So why did this music scene in particular resonate with you so strongly at the time?
Well, like I say in the documentary, I was listening to, I guess you could, I'm going to call it alternative music from, you know, a very young age. And grunge was great because it, or before it was even thought of as being called grunge, that type of music, like Mudhoney, they were an incredible, just aggressive rock band bringing together punk energy with what I would say was sort of like rock music. So it was really infectious, very much like what the Misfits did or the Ramones. And I loved it. It was great. It was I guess you could say it was sort of easy to listen to if you compare it to hardcore music, which was popular at the time. Yeah, that's why, I guess.
Yeah, like I know I got into grunge when I was in high school, though it happened for me like when it was being remarketed in the early 2000s. But it's very melodic, a lot of it, which I know was one of the things that people talked about at the time. So, like, kind of more in line with classic rock, but, like, harder punk edge, which makes it so appealing.
Yeah, I would say, I would guess that a lot of people, they almost purely associate Nirvana with grunge and sort of heavy lyricism and sort of depression. But the overall idea of grunge music was really just like the idea of grungy guitar, like distorted guitar, which is a sort of a very rock and roll idea.
Yeah, it seemed like their take on bass was a big part of it too. The whole
the instruments themselves, although distorted, were more you could actually sort of hear them as opposed to just a huge wash of right around that time, Norwegian metal was kind of becoming something, and the hardcore scene and the punk scene, which was very much about low-end recording and just crappy recording, whereas, like, grunge music actually had some production value behind it, and it was recorded well.
I know that some criticism around grunge was that it had higher production value, and so it started to appeal to a more mass audience than a lot of punk rock had in the 80s. Was that something that you noticed when you were listening to it in the 90s, in the early 90s?
I think at the time when I was listening to it, I wasn't associating it with like punk. I thought of it as, there was sort of like a Red Hot Chili Peppers group of people. There were, there was like 24/7 Spies and Red Hot Chili Peppers and Jane's Addiction and all that music, which was kind of like its own scene. And then there was like funk type music happening, and then there was a lot of poppy punk coming out too, like Green Day and Mr. T Experience. Like, there was a lot of stuff happening in all different camps, and I don't think I thought of necessarily as Mudhoney as like punk. Like, you wouldn't really see people with mohawks and things like that. It was just, that's when that expression began being used. Alternative music was sort of around that time. So I think I thought of it as something new, I guess.
Right. Do you think there was something unique happening in Vancouver that was totally separate from the Seattle grunge scene?
I think maybe that was kind of one of the ideas I was sort of trying to get at, like, because, Vancouver, or maybe the people don't, but Vancouver was so hugely influential in the sort of early to mid-80s with DOA, and there was a lot of great punk bands, Death Sentence, Another Kind of Blues, Subhumans, Pointed Sticks, Art Bergman, all that stuff. So there was a lot going on here, and there was actually sort of a new wave thing that happened in Vancouver. But by the late 80s, the music scene in Vancouver was beginning to be more, in my opinion, more folk rock. It was a lot more like folk bands and blues bands and things like that. It kind of went away from the punk thing, and I don't think there was as many recording opportunities in Vancouver in the early 90s as there once was. So the scene in Vancouver seemed to be kind of in a limbo state, and perhaps the Seattle bands reignited the music scene in Vancouver in a way.
Yeah, I was going to ask, actually, because I noticed that you opened the documentary with a young Canadian song, as listeners will hear once we play it. And I was wondering if that was you trying to kind of, like, bridge the gap between that, like, an 8-9 year period between the beginning of grunge and the end of what some consider, like, the first punk scene in Vancouver.
I used that song in a sense just to show my first sort of hearing of what would be considered outside of the mainstream type music, and also like it was on a cassette, and cassettes were traded around, and Art Bergman was part of the Vancouver scene, and it was much more I would think of the Young Canadians as a punk band.
You talk a lot about venues in your documentary. So did you have personal favorites that you tended to go to a lot?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that was another theme I was trying to explore. Like, Vancouver was full of places to go to see shows back then. The New York Theater that was on Commercial was definitely a great place to see music. Sonic Youth played quite a well-publicized show there. And right around that, I think Skullskates had a venue called the Nappy Dugout, which was a great place. There was a place called The World, which was sort of an after-hours place, Richards on Richards. The Smiling Buddha, of course, was sort of the most famous. I'd say pretty much they're all gone, except for the Commodore. The Starfish Room was another one. And the Commodore is still a great venue, although it doesn't seem like that many shows go on there anymore. But the New York Theater was, I think, sort of the coolest one for me.
What made it coolest? Like, can you kind of paint a picture of what it was like? Because I think a lot of people listening in wouldn't have seen it.
The New York Theater was kind of a smaller, I believe it was an old movie theater that is sort of somewhat could be considered in a residential area of Vancouver. And the seating, I'm pretty sure it was a movie theater, but the seating was tiered like a theater, and there was a stage, and there was a small area that, you know, you could stand. I believe that quite well-known photo of a person completely upside down stage diving, that photo, I believe, was taken at the New York Theater, I'm pretty sure, by a Vancouver photographer. But it had lots of great shows. I saw Beyond Possession there, and I saw Suicidal Tendencies there, and it was just sort of the place to go to. It was a great scene, I guess you could say.
Talking about stage diving and stuff, you always hear about the violence and intensity of, like, the pit when people talk about grunge scenes, especially when it first got going. Do you have any heroic stories of, like, surviving a really intense mosh pit at shows that you went to?
I'm not that tall, so I wasn't really a big mosh pit warrior. I've researched a lot about the whole that sort of came out of Huntington Beach, the HB strut, et cetera, like the violence in gigs and that. But the biggest mosh pit memory I have is actually I saw what do they call it? I saw Suicidal Tendencies open for Megadeth at the P&E. And you had all these sort of punker, skateboardery types sort of moshing around. And then anytime any of them tried to get out of the pit, there was a circle of bikers that kept pushing them back in as they thought it was quite funny. The greatest mosh pits can be seen on YouTube if you search out the Cro-Mags and Agnostic Front and that kind of thing. They just seem completely crazy. But I was never a mosh pit guy.
Yeah, like, I'm a woman, so they still have mosh pits at shows that I'll go to occasionally, but it tends to be a pretty hostile environment, no matter how tall you are. It can just be really, really scary. That's terrifying to imagine a bunch of people preventing you from escaping.
Yeah. Yeah, I've gotten a few elbows in the nose, and that I don't completely understand why the mosh pit still exists.
Yeah, maybe it's another weird hearkening back through for nostalgia.
That's another story, but I mean, I remember seeing Fugazi in North Vancouver, which was a show Nardwar brought to Vancouver and promoted, and Nardwar has talked to Ian MacKaye recently about that show. But I do remember Ian MacKaye kept stopping the show because he didn't want people moshing, mosh pit, or slam mosh. Nardwar had some new term for it. I forget what it was. Slam moshing or something like that. Anyway, but that created more hostility because people were like, don't tell us what to do. And it's kind of a hard thing. I guess eventually it will run its course and something else will happen.
Yeah, that's interesting that you bring up Ian MacKaye. And I know you in the documentary you talk briefly about some of the women who were involved in the scene in Vancouver. And I've read a little bit about the Riot Girl presence in Vancouver coming off of like what started in Olympia. And I know one of their biggest things was like Girls to the Front and trying to make shows more accessible space for everyone and not just like guys who really wanted to beat the crap out of each other. So did you ever witness any of that at shows in Vancouver?
Well, Cub definitely were promoting a more fun, I think, environment at shows. And they were all women, and they, I believe they encouraged, you know, other women to create bands. I'm sure they must have, because their shows were great, and they were a great band. There was a local artist named Brain Eater. He's still here. He's Brain Eater. And I know he created a lot of clothing. Like, I remember when I was in high school, my grade 8, that kind of thing, that would have been 1984 or 85. It was much more sort of a goth, I guess you could say, kind of thing. And Brain Eater made clothing and that. And I remember going to, like, I was quite young, but I remember going to see the Cramps at UBC, and it was a very even guys to girls crowd. And there was no slam dancing or anything like that. There was maybe some stage diving, but it was from both male and female. But the clothing was, like, a big part of it, and it was sort of a more artistic, I guess you could say it was sort of a more artistic, inclusive, I guess you could say, scene, because, the music somehow, like, that was kind of the undoing of grunge music, is that the people that kind of, the artists set out to distance themselves were sort of became the majority of the audience, and then the shows in that became, you know, Strongest Survive and that kind of thing.
Totally. It's always interesting to me to see, like, or movements that branch off of any given movement once it kind of becomes owned by, like, a certain group of people. And that seems
right.
Like how subculture perpetuates itself.
There were quite a few bands, like Sleater-Kinney and... like the whole Portland and Vancouver, the Riot Girl movement, and that. I mean, there were a lot of there was a lot of notable women involved in the scene. That, like, the alternative music scene was like there were as many men as women, it seemed, in a sense, I'd say.
One other thing I noticed in your doc was that you use music medleys as a way to kind of express different sounds within grunge rather than just playing like a whole song. And I was wondering why you chose to present the sound that way.
Well, I mean, an hour isn't that long when you're trying to sort of convey quite a long time period. But, I tried to find some music that may not have been as widely known as, say, Nirvana, or even though I did play some Nirvana, but widely known as Mudhoney and that kind of thing. There was not that. I mean, Green River, they were a pretty great band, but it is interesting when I was talking to Stephen Hamm about how they were sort of all those bands were glam rock influenced and that kind of thing. So, you know, I wanted to play as much music as I could, but the songs are quite long. I mean, that's another big difference between, say, grunge and the it's influenced by punk, but I mean, punk songs on average were like 2 minutes, and grunge songs were much longer than that for the most part. So I was just trying to get, you know, some of these songs heard that many people may not have heard in the past. And, you know, it paints sort of a nice image when you can hear a few songs in a short time period. Plus, you know, everybody's attention span is so much less now. So.
Who are some bands that you really miss watching now?
I actually personally didn't see Nirvana, but I have friends that saw them a few times, and they said, you know, in their early sort of period, they were an amazing live band. But a band I specifically, I mean, I didn't actually see that many grunge shows. That was one of the things, you know, in research, you know, there were like, the shows weren't necessarily like small shows. They were generally like a big thing, like the show I did see at UBC for Mudhoney. I mean, that was like a 1,000-person, 6 bands or whatever it was, big show. You know, they were events for the most part. But Mudhoney was great. I know they've reunited a few times, or maybe they've never broken up, but they don't play that often. But I think Mudhoney are an amazing band, and I haven't seen them in, you know, a long, long time. So I miss seeing Mudhoney.
Yeah, they toured kind of recently with Pearl Jam, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I was never... The grunge thing, too, is, like, so diverse. Like, so many bands, like Pearl Jam and Mudhoney, don't sound anything alike.
No.
They're both kind of under this umbrella of this genre, which is kind of funny. But, I was going to say they're Be Happening as well, which I'm not sure. I think they're in the grunge scene as well. they opened for Mudhoney, and they're kind of an underappreciated band. Screaming Trees, they were sort of a great band as well.
Yeah, well, so many bands get kind of thrown together when people try to write the history of a scene. They'll just throw any band that was around under that umbrella, even if the sounds are super diverse. So there are definitely some things that fall under the purview of grunge that don't quite fit the mold when you're listening through it.
I was just going to say, like, when certain, you know, if someone says New York hardcore, in my mind, I know exactly what that band is going to sound like. Whereas with the grunge scene, it could be anything from, you know, Love Battery to Soundgarden or something.
Yeah, for sure.
A heavy Led Zeppelin-esque guitar-driven band, and Mudhoney, you know, almost sound like Dinosaur Jr. at times. Well, you know, one great thing about this was just being able to actually, you know, the 90s haven't really been documented that well yet. But certainly the 70s, 80s, 60s, 50s have. So that was sort of an exciting thing, because most of the people I spoke to were like, oh, you know, this is cool. Like, I haven't thought about this, you know. I got to talk to a bunch of interesting, you know, people, and the Vancouver music scene hasn't been documented that well in that time period, you know, sort of post the golden years of punk in Vancouver. So I hope, you know, the stories that were told were, you know, are interesting to hear. And I want to say thank you to Nardwar, Angela, Tyler, and Valerie.
You've just been listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc series. We would like to thank UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund, Peter Doolin, Emily Morgan, Shyla Seller, and Katie Harris for researching, digitizing, and cataloging our archive tape. Thanks to Robert and Bronwyn at the UBC Library Digitization Center for partnering with us to digitize, launch, and host the audio collection. And Erwin at the UBC University Archives, thank you to Nardwar the Human Serbiette and to Madeline Taylor for organizing this project and supporting our documentary producers.
And
visit our website, citr.ca/docs, for podcasts, interviews with the producers, and more information. You're listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We are broadcasting from the ancestral, unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. In the last year, CITR has been digitizing our collection of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes containing an archive of audio broadcast on UBC's campus and community radio station from 1949 to